and welcome to Film Kid Asks, the podcast where I ask questions to working professionals in the film industry from the perspective of someone just getting started. My name is Jordan, and today I'm joined by the Canadian producer from projects like In the Tall Grass, Splice, Ginger Snaps, and the Oscar-winning animated short, Ryan, Stephen Hoban. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Steve.
It's great to be here. I'm kind of interested that you say the Canadian producer, because I don't really look upon myself as a Canadian producer. I just look upon myself as an independent producer. And I think it'd be worth talking about that a little bit, because I think Canadian producers and Canadian filmmakers have a way of looking at themselves and think that we're in a completely different situation from producers around the world when we're really not. There are two kinds of producers and only two kinds of producers, broadly speaking. There's independent producers and there's Hollywood producers, and that's all. And Canadian producers fall into the independent category.
That's fair. It was more of a Canadian pride thing. As a Canadian myself, I like shouting that out. However, I would love to talk a little bit more about what being an independent producer is. And I guess to kick that off, how would you define the role of a producer and how would you differentiate those two things?
All right, well, I'm going to keep this really short because you could spend an hour just talking about what a producer is. There's so many different kinds of producers. And it probably is the most misunderstood role in the entire film and television business. And there are other kinds of businesses related to film and television specifically. Today, I can really only talk about film and TV and more film than television. So I'll focus on that. But now there's such an interesting time. I mean, young filmmakers and upcoming filmmakers, you guys are in for the most interesting time. Maybe the best time, maybe not the best time, who knows? But with Quibi and all sorts of different ways to get content out and podcasts, and then there's going to be hybrid kinds of podcasts and film and TV. So I don't even know where that's going to go. You guys are going to invent that. So I'll talk about film and TV in particular. So with film, I mean, there's the primary producer who is generally the most responsible for the production, and we'll break that down a little bit as we go on, is just called the producer. Then there's executive producers, which historically going back 100 years used to be the guys who would help raise the money, and they were all guys back then. And they tended to be business oriented and money oriented. That's now changed quite a lot. So now executive producers can be people who bring elements to the table. So actors are often becoming executive producers just by attaching themselves to a project. They become an element that helps make that movie happen. And then there's co-producers. They tend to be somebody who is working directly with the producer, the person who's ultimately in charge. And often they're either junior in the industry to that producer, or they're not junior, but they're not as heavily responsible. So they could be a very senior producer, but they're only helping on certain things. Nowadays, that really ends up usually getting the executive producer or producer credit, but that's historically what a co-producer is. Then there's associate producer, which is really the beginning kind of producer. Very often, again, especially in the Hollywood system, more so in the independent system, somebody would be an associate producer who had previously been an assistant to a producer or a director or somebody involved that was sitting in on creative meetings and production meetings, and then started to be able to take on greater responsibilities, such as helping to look for something or do research on something, and then increase their value to the production. So you got an associate producer credit, which is a really great thing to do if you want to become a producer, to start working that way. Then there's creative producer, which is a very unusual credit, but you'll see it occasionally. And sometimes that's somebody who isn't really an experienced producer, but maybe has found the rights to a novel and has brought it to a more seasoned producer and might get that credit. And then the last producer credit in film is the line producer. The line producer is really different from all the other producer credits. That person has the most defined job description in all the producer roles, because really it's what previously had been a production manager. And that's somebody who we can get into it if you want later on, but who is really responsible for the nuts and bolts of the budget, putting it together, hiring crew, all under the guidance of the producer. But that's really their physical role, especially on bigger productions. It's just become such an important, hard job that years and years ago, we started to give the line producer credit for that. And so sometimes line producers then transition to being full producers. But the only producer that usually has that final responsibility to everybody else, to banks, to financiers, to creative people, to the director, the actors, is the producer, that single title.
So what would you define yourself as? What do you usually, are you usually a producer or how do you define your role?
I'm a producer, and I've gotten probably one or two, I think, executive producer credits over the years, where I just helped somebody on a production that I really didn't develop myself and I didn't pull together, but you know, maybe I helped bring a piece of the financing to the table or gave some confidence to, you know, a financier or a bank or somebody. But I'm a producer, and I'll tell you what the TV producer is really quickly, and then I'll define the kind of producer that I am, which I think encompasses what the overall producer, capital P, as opposed to co-producer and all those other roles are. So, and I've listened to some of the podcasts so far, by the way, they're fantastic. And you've heard some really great things about television, and the ones I've listened to, it seems to be more about TV than film, which isn't surprising because in the independent world, that's really where filmmakers have gravitated to because you've been able to make a living at it. Whether you're a writer, a director, a producer, it's just really hard in the independent film business. So in the TV business, what is the producer or the final say for a movie is an executive producer in TV. And I remember when I was started to learn about that 6 or 7 years ago, I was irritated. Now, why don't they just call it producer instead of executive? Because it makes it very confusing. So much so that on one of the last movies I did, our first AD referred to me to somebody came on set, somebody kind of important, and referred to me, was trying to say that of the various producers involved, I was the producer. So she referred to me as the executive producer. That's very telling that she's coming from TV. So the executive producer is really the person in charge, very often, almost always a writer. So, and almost all the producer credits in television are given to writers, as it's a writer's medium as opposed to a director's medium, which is what film is generally considered to be. You probably all know that. So in television, there's executive producers, co-executive producers, supervising producer, then co-producer, and it goes down that way. And those are the people who start off as writers, usually as a staff writer or a story editor, and then work their way up. There is one kind of producer in TV that mimics directly a role in film, and that's the equivalent to line producer. Except, very confusingly, that title is just producer. The same thing as the top boss in film is really the line producer in television. So I've now started getting involved in TV. So, you know, we're talking about, we're interviewing producers, and I just think of them as line producers. Everyone's calling them producers. Somehow it just sounds wrong to me because the producer is the one that gets in trouble if everything goes wrong, but not so in television.
So what you're saying is it's very simple and clear cut and well-defined.
Exactly. There are producers not in the TV business because it's very regimented, but in the film business who don't necessarily really understand the full role of producer. So shall I break down what a producer in film does? Because that's really what I do.
Yeah, that's what you do. So yeah, sure. Break down kind of what you do as a day-to-day thing when you're developing a project or working in production on a project. Yeah, kind of break down what your role is as a independent film producer.
You know, the role, and that doesn't mean that's what one person fills. It's sometimes there's two producers. There's a lot of producing teams, a lot of duos, and that makes a whole lot of sense. And I have some producer friends where there's three of them that produce together. And then sometimes on projects, there's producers that don't always work together that come together. So sometimes it's more than one person that fills all of these responsibilities, but they really break down to four. There's creative, there's financial, there's legal, and then there's logistical. And they require different strengths in order to do that, which is why it's really hard for one person to be a great all-around producer, and it's entirely unnecessary. In fact, some of the producer responsibilities require somebody to be really good at something that if you are good at that, you're probably not good at the other thing. So again, to break it down even more detail, so creative, what that means is, you know, there's a novel or a comic book or even just an idea that a writer has, you generally will option that. So you're usually the first person on the ground who says that would make a good movie or sometimes a good TV show or sometimes a short film. And that's your very first responsibility. And that creative responsibility goes right through development, production, and even the release of the film, where in a way, I've always seen myself as a producer as being kind of the advocate for the audience. And so that goes right through to you in the edit room or helping to work out the marketing plan. But it really starts with, would this make a good movie? And if it makes a good movie, would it make a good movie that enough people would want to see to justify whatever the resources would take to make it? Because sometimes that's the thing. I've looked at things I wanted to do and thought, well, it would be so expensive to make it, but it's a niche thing that there's no audience that would be big enough to support a $100 million budget for something. So then you can't do it. So it really starts there. Creatively, what do you think is worth making? And it has to start from your own taste. And then it has to very quickly get to that financial side. It's like, okay, I like this. And if I like it, probably other people like it. And it might be the kind of thing I like that lots of people like, or the kind of thing that very few people like. And then that's when your very next consideration is financial. So, you know, how much money can be raised for? How much will it cost to make it? So that whole financial side involves, you know, dealing with banks. And as a producer, as an independent producer, you're always on the hook. You're more on the hook than the director is, than the writer or the cast or anybody else. I know some producers who have gotten themselves in a position where production falls apart and it's their house that's going to be taken away. Not usually the directors, it's never the actors, it's never the crew. So I think that's an important thing for producers to understand, even though almost nobody else will understand that. I feel too many producers undervalue the risks that they're taking. And I think it's really important to, nobody undervalues the director, nobody undervalues the script. They do undervalue writers very often in film, but they don't undervalue the script and they don't undervalue the cast. But it's really easy to undervalue a producer. And for any of you that may go on to becoming producers, don't do that. To be responsible to yourself, to your projects, and to the whole profession of producing, don't do that. It's a really important, incredibly hard role. I do think it's the hardest role in the film business is being a producer. I think it can be highly rewarding. I found it really rewarding, and I have a number of producer friends who also do. I have quite a larger number of friends who have had a really hard time at it and not been able to make it work because it's just so difficult. So those are the creative, financial, then there's legal. And, you know, most of the people listening to this podcast, you know, won't have a whole lot of experience. I got really lucky with one of my early jobs where I did get to really understand contracts and legals. So I don't really need to hire lawyers until we're far into the process. But again, it's one of the sides that you need to understand. But with a lawyer, they will help you go through that and create the kind of contracts that you need to. Contracts are critical to any production. You know, maybe not so much a short film, but then even handshake and verbal contracts, they really are important. It's about understanding and everybody being on the same page. So it's really very, very important, even if you don't understand contracts in detail, to understand the intent behind every contract, because they're really, in some ways, they're part of the backbone of any production. The last aspect of being a producer is logistical. So you need to understand the logistics. And again, you don't need to be great at it yourself. Maybe you are. Maybe you're fantastic at it. If you are, you should weigh in a lot more. But if not, you know, you've got a production manager or a line producer, you've got first AD, you've got a director, you've got a team, and you can be involved and you can help to troubleshoot that stuff, but you don't need to be great at it. But at the end of the day, you will always be looked at and somebody will say, and the keys, your key crew love to do this to you. The ADs especially, and the production managers, they love to say, well, Steve or whoever, what do you want to do? Do you want to do this or do you want to do this? And you're going to be having a ton of pressure to do this. And if you do that, you're fucked. And for some reason, you're not going to have enough money or you're going to go to jail. Like the stakes can become really, really high, really easily. And crews know that because they're not the producer. And they are very happy, the key crew, to shove it off to you. Having said that, I'm not trying to make them sound bad because they also almost always want to be your ally. And we'll get into integrity and all that stuff, which is, in a way, actually, I think kind of should be the fifth element of being a producer, is your integrity. So those are the four aspects of it.
Yeah, for sure. And we'll get more granular as we go along. But yeah, thank you for sharing. That was actually very comprehensive. So jumping back a little bit to your origin story, you worked as a VP of business affairs at a completion bond company before becoming a producer. So what is that, first of all? And then we'll talk a little bit about what that role taught you and what you brought from that into your role as a producer.
So a completion bond or a completion guarantor, it's a kind of insurance that productions get. Studios don't do it because they self-guarantee the productions. Streamers like Netflix and Amazon, they also don't get it. But any independent movie traditionally, if it's over a certain budget, would have a completion guarantee. And what that is that's a contract between the producer pays for it and negotiates it, but it's not for the producer, it's for the financiers. And so basically it's guaranteeing to the financiers that if they put in the amount of money they say they're going to, that that movie will be, or TV series will be delivered on the schedule, so on time and on budget. And if it's going to take longer or cost more, and generally if it takes longer, it's going to cost more, the guarantor will pay the difference. So what that means is the completion guarantor has to be able to monitor the production every day and make sure it stays on track. And if it doesn't stay on track, put it on track. And that can involve even taking over the whole production, firing the producer, firing a director, firing anybody, and finishing it. So I can't imagine that there is a better film school for being a producer than working in a completion bond company. I started off as an assistant, and I got really lucky because it was the most incredible insight into film and TV. Like, I was dealing with dozens of them every year.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. It seems like you would be dealing with quite a few aspects of what you broke down the role of a producer being, especially the logistical side and the finance side. So I can see, and the legal side. So I can see how that could be a huge asset. So very interesting. So kind of from there, what was your path into producing?
Well, I actually think my path into producing started as a reader. Probably like everybody who goes to film school is interested in storytelling in one way or another. So for me, it's story. It's always started with story. I was always a big reader in high school and in university. You know, I always started creative writing clubs, and we would publish little books that we did. I ended up being the editor for an independent comic book company at one point. So it's stories. I was always most taken and passionate about stories. For film, though, I'd never seriously thought about film, even though I'd made a couple of films as a kid, Super 8 films, because that's how old I am. And it was really documentaries. As I finished my first degree, my only degree, at Carleton University, was in political science. So I was interested in social issues, and I decided I wanted to get into making documentaries. So that was really what made me think about film. And unlike now, where everyone has so much access to information about the film business, it was really hard when I was starting. So I didn't even think it was possible. But then I started to do research. I was just moving to Toronto at that time because my girlfriend was moving there for school. I thought, wow, they make movies in Toronto. So I could get into documentaries. And so that was the idea, to start turning my sights to film. But then I met a friend who I didn't even know was in the city, and he was working at the Canadian Film Center, which I'm sure everyone here in Canada knows, but that was Norman Jewison's Film Center that is here in Canada. And at that time, it was relatively new and pretty rarefied. You know, they would invite people like Michael Ondaatje and people like that to come and be what they called residents. And so I had a friend who worked there. Together, we decided to produce a short film. So we optioned a short story. So nothing to do with the film center. It was on the side. And to me, that fit because it was film. It wasn't documentary, but it was still film and it was storytelling. And we never made that short film because then with this friend, Rick, I met John Fawcett, who you've interviewed. And so we made a short film with John that was at the film center. And so that started the fiction film for me. And just to step back, but when Rick was there at the film center, I was still thinking documentaries, but at that time, they were in their production office for a short film they were making. They had Mac computers and PCs. And because of a previous job I had, I knew both and they didn't. And they needed them to talk to each other. So I just came to help them out in the office. And I just got bit by the bug. I saw what production was like and it was so much fun. And I decided I wanted to do it. And then I didn't know how to do it because I didn't know any jobs. And that's when I decided with Rick, we would just option a short story and I'd produce. I thought that was the one job you could do without any experience would be a producer. And kind of in a way it was.
Jumping in head first. That's awesome. So Where, kind of going back to now, you know, where you are and what you do, where do you find the properties and ideas that you develop? Is that something that you go searching for? Is that something that people come to you with? Is it a mix of both? How does that work?
Well, it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about reading. I'm amazed at how many meetings I've been in over the years where somebody brings up a book or an author and I was just familiar. It's in fact, really, in a way, I think as a film producer, I think my best experience started when I was still in university. I was assistant manager for a bookstore in Ottawa. And because I love science fiction and horror, I was given control over, editorial control in a way, over the bookstore. And the manager was happy to leave it to me. So I turned it into the best home for science fiction, fantasy, and horror in Ottawa. And so I got to know, even though I never really read fantasy very much, I got to know everything in science fiction, horror, and fantasy. So I became kind of an authority on it. Since then, it's just helped me. I could be in meetings somewhere and people would bring up a writer and I would just know. So it really is knowing where to find material. And it could, that happened to be my taste. So if I was, you know, interested in comedy or romance, I mean, just read those things, get to know whatever the section of the industry is you want to go into. And I think it's very helpful to focus. The other thing that happened is when I decided to actually become a film producer, again, it was a long time ago, at that time I thought there were two kinds of movies, and only two kinds of movies, that you could make in Canada without movie stars that would have a chance of international success. And I think you always need to be thinking about the international audience. You should never think just about the Canadian audience. And those two movies were either horror films or family films. So I set out at that time to develop one of each. And one was a film that John Fawcett ended up directing. And another was a Farley Mowat story that was my favorite book as a kid. And we never made that family movie, but we did make the movie Gingersnaps. And it kind of became a path of least resistance, because you could make horror movies for a lower budget. Even though when we made that movie, actually, in Canada, this is a lot of years ago, it was $4.7 million. I remember it was one of the most expensive Canadian movies being made, which seemed amazing to me. And it seems so low now, but probably in today's dollars, it's like, I don't know, $7 million or something. It was a lot of money. I just found it by following my tastes. And then the other way that I get projects is also relationships. So, and that's probably one of the most important things anybody in film school or anybody starting out should be really concentrating on right now, is at that stage, figuring out what you like, what you think you can speak to people about with passion. Because if you can do that, that's a big part of becoming successful. Like if I was out there, you know, trying to sell a YA novel, it's just not me. I don't really watch that stuff. But the people who do are really successful now. It's such a great subgenre now. And now, I mean, I've been around enough. I can work with others that do that, and I could probably be helpful in making something like that work. But it doesn't, not enough coming from me to start with, I don't think. But on the relationship side, you know, if you're a producer and, you know, there's a writer you know, and they're really passionate about something, that could be a great combination. Or director, it's about those collaborations, and then projects come to you that way. And they can come from anything. They can come from an article, they can come from an idea, or they can say, The Wizard of Oz, how come nobody's remade that? Let's just our own weird version of it. They can come from anywhere. And it's just got to be what you spark to. And like I said earlier, you think you can actually get made. I had a project for 16 years that I kept trying to get made. And I now it's being made as a TV series. But it would have cost $100 million to make it. It was a massive science fiction fantasy. It was an adaptation of a novel, this thing called The Dragon Rise of Pern that Anne McCaffrey wrote. And there was no way I could make it. I just wasn't connected in the Hollywood studio system. And that could only have been made as a Hollywood studio movie. There's no other way to make it. And no matter how worthy the project might have been, I was the wrong producer to get it made. So you need to be able to make it. Don't bite off more than you can chew. That doesn't mean don't be ambitious. You should definitely be bold and ambitious. That's very important, but be realistic as well.
I think that's great advice. So pitching is a huge part of your job. How can young people improve their pitching skills, and what makes for a good pitch?
In a way, it's storytelling. So there's a few aspects to the story you're telling when you pitch. So there's the creative of whatever the project is, whether that's a TV series or it's a movie or a web series or anything, there is the creative story. And you need to be able to talk to people about it so that they understand it and get excited about it. And you could be pitching something that is about an audience that the person you're pitching it to has no connection to. You could be pitching to a 60-year-old man, you know, something about a high school romance. You still have to be able to get that 60-year-old to engage with it creatively, which usually means characters, because people always respond to the emotion. It means originality. So you have to find what the strengths are of the project, and you have to know how to pitch them creatively in a story sense and tell a story. You also need to tell another story. And this is separate from the writer or director's story, which sometimes the producer has to pitch in producer-driven projects. That's why I would be pitching it, as opposed to a director or writer. But in all scenarios, even if it is you have a director or writer both with you pitching, there's still the producer side of the story, which is separate and distinct from the creative. And that's the story about why whoever you're pitching to should support it. And so part of that starts with knowing who you're pitching to in the first place. Now, you can't always go in knowing that they want that. Like, you could be pitching to a broadcaster or to a financier that, you know, has $10,000 that will help you get a short film made. You need to understand as much as you can going into it, what they're looking for, what they're receptive to. And it doesn't mean you shouldn't necessarily pitch an outlier that they've never done before. I mean, for all you know, that may be exactly what they were talking about in a staff meeting the week before they need. But you can usually tell that if you go to CBC Gem and you try to pitch, you know, $100 million TV series, it's a waste of time. There's no way in the world. They just simply can't do it. So you need to know who you're pitching to, and then you need to weave into the overall pitch why it's good for them. You know, whether that's somebody who's at a government agency who has a little bit of money, or whether that's a TV broadcaster or a streamer or a distributor for movies, you have to know what they're looking for and pitch them why it's good for them to do it. But be very careful to not assume you know. Like, try to know as much as you can, but never word it in such a way where it seems like you're being trying to be smart and know more and tell them what their business is. Never, never do that.
That seems like it can be a tricky line, but that's great advice. So I think as film students, the role of producing is very broad. As you discussed, like as you kind of broke down earlier, it's a complicated series of roles, really. But could you walk us through the development process specifically, and how long it can take for a project to get ready to, and then, you know, be greenlit, and what that looks like, the development phase?
Well, it's from the time you start to develop a project to the time it gets made can be anywhere from a few months to a decade. So that's unfortunately the way that goes. And you generally never know when you go into it what it's going to be. So I'll just give you an example of the kinds of projects we usually develop at my company. So we would probably start by optioning either an idea that a writer has, or we would be optioning the rights to a novel. And then if it's the rights to a novel, we would then find a writer. And that process is it's probably the most important process, most important decision at the beginning part of the process, for sure. So that could mean go out to several different writers, tell them about the book or article or whatever you're basing it on, and ask them to come to you with their take on it. And then they will be pitching to you, and they'll be telling, and they will either be telling you a compelling story or not. Or maybe they won't have it figured out, which is sometimes okay, but they'll be telling you what they would want to do with it. And if it sounds really compelling, then that's the writer you go with. More likely at, you know, the beginning stage, you have one writer friend or a couple, and you already know which one would be, you know, more suitable for this or that. And then you enter into an agreement. And even if it's a feature film, you have to have a written agreement no matter what. It's probably not a bad idea to do for a short film as well, but even if you don't have a written contract, you have to have a clear understanding of what everyone's responsibilities are and what everyone's going to get out of it. more producers create more trouble for themselves by not dealing with things head on, and then the problems just start to compound. So if you know you've got a writer who thought, well, I was going to be able to be making decisions on casting or choosing the director, or and maybe that's your deal. Maybe your deal is you're going to share those decisions. Maybe it's not. And it's so easy to just put off a hard conversation, but it's almost always a bad idea. It will almost always come and bite you in the butt if you don't, in advance, just make it clear to everybody. And sometimes it feels like an uncomfortable conversation, but the second you've had it and it's over, you think, oh, thank God. So now I don't have to go to bed at night worrying about it. And I'm a producer who doesn't go to bed at night worrying about very many things, but I know a lot who do. And they're usually the ones who are trying to duck problems. And some problems, it is worth letting them sit for a while because sometimes they solve themselves. But generally, just nip it in the bud. That's what you want to do. Make it really clear for everybody. And just a little bit on that relationship with the writer. I think it's really important to, especially when you're starting off, you don't have a lot to offer. They don't have a lot to offer. The director coming on doesn't have a lot to offer except your time. And hopefully your passion and your commitment to each other. And I would say you want partners, because they're all partners, who will treat it like a partnership and will give as much of them as you. And it's like any kind of endeavor in life when you've got to work with other people. If somebody's working harder than somebody else, it's just going to cause resentment, or it's going to make the project not be as good as it should be. So I've always tried to go into the partnerships that I've done just being generous and expecting my partners to be generous as well. I don't want more out of it than them. Like when we made Ginger Snaps on a deal side, because this was the beginning part of it, it was that was actually John Fawcett's idea. So it wasn't based on a novel, but he had the idea of, you know, these two girls, two sisters, and then pitched the idea to Karen Walton. And then we did an agreement, and the agreement we did, which I only did that once and I'll never do again. And I'll tell you why. As a producer, it's good to know this. It was the three of us are all equal. So if the movie makes any money, we all get it equally. Everything is equal. Our profit participation, our ownership and everything. And that seemed to me when I started out, well, how could that be wrong? So it's a third, a third, a third. What, that seems fair. And but then I realized after we made the movie, and then, you know, Karen got hired to do other things and John was off being hired to do other things. And I was still working on Ginger Snaps for 2 years. I was, oh yeah, I have a responsibility that goes far beyond their responsibility. And as a producer, if you are an independent producer, your responsibility never ends to all the different financiers. So now what our general deal is at my company is 50% goes to my company. The other 50% is shared, writer, director, producer, which includes me if I'm producing it. We have a couple projects where I'm not the producer. But the company, I've now realized, needs to have half, because if you're lucky enough to grow and bring on a bit of staff, you won't be able to hire them. And I had to bring on staff because there was so much work to do on the older movies that I would never be able to make a new movie. I would still be dealing with festivals or different people asking for prints and things like that. Or it's so much work. So it's really good to have a clear relationship up front and understand what everyone's responsibilities and obligations are, and then stick to it.
Kind of going off of that though, because you did talk about like the creative side of it, how involved are you in the creative decisions when developing a project with a writer or a director or both?
Well, it's most of the projects I've done, we've had all three. So it's been the writer, the director, and me, the producer, involved. And so it's generally been equal across the board. There's a couple of movies we've done that were more producer-driven. So if there was a disagreement, and it would never be any animosity, but if there's disagreement, then it would have to be me who would have to be most confident with whatever decision. So I would make the decision. Usually it's the director. And I would say in some instances, the director and I would let the writer really make a decision if we were all uncertain, based on what kind of issue it was and our confidence in the writer. But generally, film is a director's medium. So unless it's like we've made sequels of movies and there's other things, like we've got a project now that's we've optioned a novel and we don't have a director involved at the moment. So I'm standing in, I won't direct the movie, but I'm standing in as the director, as that final creative arbiter. for us, it's usually it's me and the writer, or me and the writer and the director. And if it's me and the writer, then we bring on a director and then give them a lot of creative control as well.
So what are some of the biggest challenges a producer generally faces on a project?
Oh my God. Well, all right. Well, let me go back to the development process, because that'll take us right into the biggest challenges. So the biggest challenge, I think, when you're starting out is really figuring out what it is. Very often you think, okay, we're going to make a TV series about this, or we're going to make a movie about that. And you start working on it, and you have to, you can have an idea of what you think it is, and it might even be really clear, but often you really find what it's about or the strength of it as you go through the development process. So, you know, we've had a couple of projects where, oh, it's two drafts and this is it. This is the movie for sure. And other times, you know, we get to draft six and realize, what? This is really her story and not his story, and you have to change it. So it's about finding out what the movie really is. Like for me now, I like concept movies where concepts are important, but I'm character driven in terms of my taste. So it's about finding that character storyline, because that's what people identify with. People might go to the theater or watch a movie because of the concept, the two lines that you read about. But then what's going to make it successful or not usually is the character journey and what people are, the themes that they're connecting with. So that's the hardest part at the script stage, is really figuring that out. And you know, we've sometimes you've got the right project but the wrong writer. I've made the mistake in the past of just sticking with writers way too long, and I've learned now that, you know, sometimes some writers just they're not going to crack it. And we've never ever in any of the projects I've done left it to the writer alone to crack, but the writer still has to bring a voice to it. So, and because projects sometimes change, you learn and realize, this really is not the best writer for it. And we've never switched writers without the writers we switch from really, this is really not working. And it's only ever worked out by switching writers. So be prepared to follow where the story and the script is trying to take you. That's the script development stage. Then it's about getting the resources together to make it. So that's usually the financing. It's not always the financing though. I mean, nowadays, I mean, you can make movies on cell phones. So the resources are the people, your team, your crew, and then almost always some sort of money. You still got to feed people. There's certain things you have to do, because of course, in the film and TV business, we feed everybody, unlike some businesses. So you're always going to need money for that and some other consumables, even if everything else is thrown in gratis. So you probably need money from somebody. So that's kind of the hardest element for every project, other than a self-made short film. Every movie, TV series ever made, that was probably the hardest for all of them. So how do you get it? How do you get that money? And that part of that ties into what we were talking about earlier about pitching. You've got to find the right homes for it. There's no point, you know, knocking on the doors of, you know, 10 places that would never say yes. And again, that could be, you know, public financiers, independent financiers. It can be family and friends. I don't really encourage that. But if it's not a lot of money, maybe that's a good way to go sometimes. We just made a movie that's about to start hitting the festival circuit in 2 weeks, actually. It was the lowest budget movie we've ever made. We made it for $1 million. And the director who wrote it as well had a friend who he used to work for who was willing to put money into it. And so it ended up being not a big piece of it, but it was, you know, about 25% of the budget. And that really, that made a big difference, because then I was able to raise the other 75% from various sources. And without that 25%, it would have been a lot harder, maybe even impossible for that movie. So it's about raising the money and any other resources that you need. And that means telling that story as to why people should support it. It's why they think they'll see it. Usually it's about a return on investment. And so you need to understand, you know, how it fits into the market. And that's that other side of it. Like, there's projects I've wanted to do, but I know there's no way they will ever get made. Or at least sometimes they'll never get made with me. After that Dragon Rise of Pern experience, you know, I've had a few other projects come that were really big, epic things. And I said, this is great. I love this. This would be a great movie, but I'm the wrong producer. I can't get this made. And so you should definitely go to somebody else. So it's about that. It's about understanding the market and what you think can be made. And usually it's instinct. You can tell. It's common sense more often than not. And I think as a producer, you have to learn to trust your common sense. I mean, I've learned so many times, including recently, that you know, we've done a lot of work now with some of the biggest names in Hollywood. They don't know anything we don't know at all. And they don't know anything more than I knew when I was 20 years old. It's so what you know now is probably as much as you're ever going to know, except for specifics about this. Your instincts are not going to change. You either have good instincts or you don't have good instincts. All you can do now is get more information and more knowledge. But your instincts and your what's going to make you a good or bad producer, it's already there. There's not much you can do to change it.
That's fair. I feel like a lot of it is instinctual, especially during development, finding the projects and choosing which one and finding the right team for those projects. So I guess I want to talk a little bit about the differences between producing in a smaller market like Canada versus the States, or if you want to talk more specifically about independent film versus studio. Run me through some of the differences of the different kind of, I guess, not markets that you can produce in, but kind of.
No, that's a it's an interesting question. And it's, I think, important to have an understanding of that. I think the way to look at a small market, whether, you know, any of your listeners are in Canada or in the States or Ireland or Zimbabwe, wherever you are, that's your base. And so being your base, you'll have certain advantages and certain ways to get something made. It's where you're going to be working. So that is a critical market to you. You know, all the movies that we've made, the revenues we've made from the movies have very little to do with Canada because it's a small market. But the fact that we've been able to make the movies have had a lot to do with Canada. Not all of them. They haven't all been Canadian financed movies and made for Canada, but most of them have. So the Canadian market is really important as a way to make the movie and to get support. And there will be people here who want you to be successful. People internationally, when you're starting out, don't want you to be successful. They don't want you not to be successful, but they just don't care. They're not invested, and they can't be invested in you in any way. But in Canada, they can. Whether that's your classmates or your friends, they're invested in you and you're invested in them. It's any success that any of you have can help the others. So that's a great base. If you're going to an equipment house, if you know somebody who works at one of the places that's a post facility or anybody involved in the industry, they could have a vested interest in your success. So you want to leverage that as much as possible. That's what's going to help you get your project manufactured for the world.
Right.
But when it comes to exploitation, that's the world. And even if you're making an incredibly Canadian-oriented story, if that story can't touch somebody outside of Canada, you should not make that, because that's not a story that anybody in Canada is going to be interested in either.
That makes sense. For the students that are interested in becoming producers, many will likely enter the workforce as assistants. What makes a good producer's assistant? How can they stand out?
First of all, being smart. And being smart, you're not necessarily just born with it. Being smart is about effort. So if you're assistant for a producer, you can be a little bit lazy about it and not anticipate what's needed and not work hard. You already know this. I mean, everybody knows this from the time you're a kid. You know how to please people around you by doing something that gets positive reinforcement. It's the same thing as a producer's assistant. You need to work hard, and you need to not necessarily try to impress your boss. What you want to do is you want to help your boss. And there's a bit of a fine line there. And some bosses, like me, I'm a little bit allergic to people who just want me to notice them and be impressed. I don't want people to want me to be impressed with them for the sake of being impressed. I want people who will get stuff done and be responsible and be efficient and be part of the team. Film is so hard. It's so difficult. There's so much work to do with every project that when people are thinking about it from ego or things like that, it really just starts to deflate the whole thing. So if it's about jumping in and being able to just being able to help, whatever it is, you know, within the terms of the job itself, like I don't mean, you know, getting somebody coffee and all that stuff. Sometimes that's part of the job too. Hopefully if somebody's in a producer's assistant, they'll have a producer who wants them to actually learn as well. And I would say being a good producer, again, part of not trying to impress your boss is you got to get value out of it. and they have to get value out of it. And I think at the end of the day, that's the way to look at it. You both need value, and don't be afraid to say that. So you need to give the producer value by helping to make things work for her or him in a tough day or get things done. But then also let that person know that you need to learn things. That producer's got to take some time, no matter how busy they are, and probably they're insanely busy, to explain some things. And, you know, don't ask at the wrong time when they're about to step into, you know, a production meeting or something. But, you know, say, you know, at some point, I would love it if we could spend a couple minutes. I'd like to know more about this, about budget, or that about script or schedule or any of those things. So I'd say go into being a producer's assistant knowing that it needs to be win-win. You need to be really helpful to the producer, and they need to be helpful to you learning.
I think that's great advice. So finally, what advice would you give to someone interested in producing that's just starting out today?
Well, I think a lot of producers might say facetiously, don't do it. It's really hard. So it's a hard job, but it can be really gratifying. So, and I think this is true of any job in the film business. I think you need to experiment, learn as much as you can, and then try to assess as quickly as you can, what are you good at? I have friends who are fantastic editors and want to be directors. Then there would be a terrible director. So if that's it, like, I'm not saying don't try to be the director, but, you know, listen to the world around you and what you're good at, because, you know, to be an Oscar winning editor is better than to be a failed director. And it's the same thing with producer. Everybody wants to be, you know, either a movie star or a director or a producer or a writer. But there's so many great, great jobs in the film business and the TV business on all the different departments. They're fantastic positions. And I would say that producing is the one that probably requires the most varied skills of any of them. You can be a great writer just by being able to write really well. Director involves a few more skills, but producer involves many more. However, having said that, if you're really good at a couple and you have a partner who's good at some of the others, then you're a great producing team. So that's the first thing, is determine that it is the right thing for you. You know, make a few short films and then decide. And you may gravitate to saying, I'm going to be a production designer because it turns out I'm better at that. Like I said earlier, read a lot, watch stuff, understand what is being made and what audiences are connecting with. That's really important. It doesn't mean you shouldn't have your own point of view or niche, because great things come out of that. And if everybody just followed what the mainstream was doing, it would be so boring. So you don't want to do that, but know what the market is, because even if you've got something that nobody's ever done before, if you understand the market, you can still pitch that thing better by knowing the market. And because you can find the similarities, there's nothing anybody's ever going to pitch that is completely unconnected to everything else in the world. So understand the market as well as you can. Be bold, have ideas, have strong ideas. Be prepared to challenge writers, challenge directors, challenge yourself. Know what, again, you're good at, you're not good at. So don't challenge people for the sake of it. If you're dealing with a writer who's clearly better at story than you are, and they're saying, well, no, this is why it should be this, don't just try to foist your ideas on them because they're your ideas. But, you know, you might be a better storyteller than a writer that you're working with. That doesn't mean you're a better writer, but you might be a better storyteller. And if you are, you might have those instincts that, no, this is the end of act one. This, we need to do this, not what the writer's saying. So don't be afraid to challenge writers. I've said so many times in relation to directors over the years, I have a healthy disrespect for directors. Some of my best friends are directors. But because the film business has this aura about directors that they're kind of God, it's very necessary to not buy into that. Again, you need to be respectful, and they have the final say on certain things, but they could be wrong. And if you know they're wrong, tell them they're fucking wrong. Don't accept it. It's because if you do, you're going to end up shooting something, and then it's going to be done forever, and it just won't be as good as it could have been because you didn't say what you knew to be right.
Right.
And I'd say work with directors that listen. And you guys are in a position that I will never be in now to work with beginning directors who are starting to establish their personality. It's okay to slap them down a little bit because, you know, being a director involves ego a lot. And, you know, again, I've worked with some directors with big egos and not big egos, and some with big egos but are very nice and generous. So you have to make sure that you speak your mind and have a point of view and come from a place of confidence. So not from insecurity or ego. Don't speak for the sake of saying something. However, if you're in a room, because you are a producer, you're still a leader, you need to be recognized. You need to be seen because people need to have confidence in you. And they can't have confidence in you if you're not speaking up and seeming to have a point of view. You have to have a point of view. You need to be super resilient because you're going to get no, 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 no all the time. And almost every great success story has had many, many no's. So you have to be prepared for that. You have to find another way. There's a bunch of other things, but.
Yeah, so I would love to open it up to a few of my friends now for them to ask some of their questions.
Well, I just had a question of how do you continue to stay motivated during the highs and lows of being a producer?
That is a really good question. And kind of been thinking about that recently because of the age that I'm at. And I have friends that are starting to think, I just don't want to bother with the fight anymore. And some of them with COVID that we're experiencing right now, thinking all the protocols to shoot something is such a pain in the butt. It was already hard enough already. Maybe I'll just quit. So I think to stay motivated, you just have to already, before the lows, know that it's just what you have to do, that there's really nothing else you want to do, because it is really that challenging and that difficult. And again, so satisfying. If you're helping to sort out the creative, that's like solving a puzzle. And then the financial and the logistic, those are all puzzles. And if you figured it out, it's so satisfying. And it contributes to something that, you know, directors generally can't do that, writers can't do that, the crews can't do that. They all need you. You are so important to make any of that happen, or none of it happens. So, and that's really satisfying, especially when you know, if you do go on to be producers, you'll create a lot of different things, and some will be great and some won't be great. But at the end of the day, it will have been worth it. So yeah, that's what's got to motivate you.
I just have a question regarding like starting out as a producer and what you learned throughout the process. So what is something, like, I'm a person who's interested in starting, going into producing. What is something that you didn't know when you started that you wish you knew, and any advice regarding for someone who's just getting started?
That's a good question. I think the biggest thing, and there's a million things I didn't know, but I think the biggest thing is I didn't understand the concept of mentors. Again, there was so little around when I was starting out, so I never looked for a mentor. And I would say, find a mentor, even if that's not somebody you ever meet in person or even ever talk to, find a virtual mentor. You know, look at what some other producers have done who are maybe online and talking about it, and try to follow in their footsteps in some ways. I think you can learn so much from what other people have done. There's nothing you would ever do as a producer that somebody else hasn't already done. And some of them have done it successfully, and some of them have done it unsuccessfully. So I would say, you know, find 10 mentors, because it's virtual. Like, get out there and do the research. Definitely read Hollywood Reporter and Deadline and Variety. Like, soak that up, and you'll start to find voices or producers who are producing the kind of thing you think you'd want to produce. Study them. Find out what they do and how they do it.
So my question kind of pertains to writers or just anyone in the storytelling position, but I'd love to hear your observations. Writing is something that I'm keen on, and I've heard that for a writer to be successful, and these could just be myths, that they have to find the magic bullet or the magic script. But alternately, I've heard for writers to be successful, they have to be the last person standing. They have to pay their dues, and they have to do lots and lots of work before they can move on to maybe their passion projects. So from what you've observed as a producer, where is the truth in that? What is your opinion on writers and their lifestyle and kind of what their careers kind of shape out and turn out to be?
Being a writer is a very interesting thing. It's unlike any other role in film because it's the solitary one. And I would say, as a writer, you need to have other people who want to support what you do, whether that's a passion project or hire you to work in a writing room for a TV series. You need to have two things. One, you need to find your voice. It's similar like being a producer or director. For a producer or director, you need your point of view. For a writer, you need a voice. And that doesn't mean that everything you write needs to be unique to only you, but it means that you need to somehow stand out. And that doesn't mean any kind of magic bullet or amazing concept. It means writing in a way that people connect with. And really that comes out of authenticity of voice. It really does. I know it's a little bit of a cliche to say that, but people respond to something that's real. You could be writing, you know, some fantastical science fiction story, but there's still, if there's something about you in there that somebody else can connect to, that's authentic and that's part of your voice, that's the way to go. And the second part of that is be prepared to do that passion project and find that voice, but then find other people. Like, become an assistant on a TV series, even if it's a really bad children's show. This industry, I think, is incredibly supportive. Like, I think especially the Canadian industry, more so than maybe some of the others, it's a great industry. Most people are really great, and they want to help other people succeed. So just getting seen, getting known, meeting people is really the other part of it.
That's helpful and also very reassuring. So thank you.
You're welcome.
When you're looking to option something, like an idea or a story, are there specific elements that you keep an eye out for? Is it just whatever grabs you, something like that?
But it's funny the way you word that in terms of optioning, because one of the elements is, can you afford it? that's not the creative element, but it's an interesting thing. It's, you know, what you're doing is you're taking on an obligation and a timeline, which can be really good for you because that's pressure. And this is more of a producer thing. I think in my career, I've been too patient. I think you need to be a little bit impatient because this industry is also great at letting things take forever. And then you're all young now, but you're going to be 30 and then you're going to be 40. And then, geez, what happened? So I think be impatient, but be strategically impatient. So that means sometimes you have to wait. You've sent that request for the third time to that agent to option that book and they haven't gotten back to you right away. You know, you have to modulate it. But I would say option something that you're passionate about, again, that you think there is an audience for. But there are some things you should not option if it would take a big producer or big director to get it made. There's no point. Because anything that's really attractive, a piece of IP, you probably heard that phrase now, it's intellectual property. So when you option a book, you're not likely to be able to option something. They're not going to option it to you, even if you gave them as much money as they wanted for the option, something that's going to be so attractive to the industry that a producer or a studio or anybody is going to take it on with you as the writer. That just isn't going to happen at this stage of your careers. So I would say option the stuff that we're missing, the established producers are missing, something that's, you know, interesting. There's so much stuff that goes back 100 years that people never thought of, or maybe thought of, but nobody's thought about in the last 10 years. I would say if you option something, it's probably something that should be off the beaten path, but shouldn't be.
That's really interesting and really great advice, actually. I hadn't thought of it like that. So that's a good one. Thanks, Stephanie, for the question as well. But I think I'm going to cut it off there. And I asked you to prepare 5 film recommendations. So I'm going to get you to share those now and why you chose those films.
All right. Well, being a producer, when somebody sets parameters, sometimes you look at the parameters and say, well, they're wrong. So you ignore it, like I'm doing now. So I don't have 5 that I'm going to suggest. And these aren't my favorite movies. Some of them actually might be. I'm going to talk about movies that, as producers, any of you want to be producers, it's worth looking at them, that they're good examples. And I'm talking about independent producers, so these are all going to be low-budget movies. You could also look at some directors whose careers that you may admire and see what their first movies were. Like, you know, Patty Jenkins is now doing Wonder Woman, but her first movie was a movie called Monster. And so a friend of mine produced that movie, but Patty had wanted to make this movie about this female serial killer, and she'd never made a movie before. And it was very low budget, but because it was so unique at the time and the script was so strong, they were able to get Charlize Theron to star in it, and she won an Oscar for it. So I would say that Monster is a pretty good movie to look at. 15 years ago, if you asked that question to an independent producer, almost anywhere in the world, they would mention the movie Cube. That was the movie that every independent director, every independent writer, and every independent producer, almost everywhere in the world, was looking at Cube, because it was this movie that was made for $400,000 Canadian, and it made $6 million at the French box office and $5 million at the Japanese box office. It was a huge success. And the movie was even ripped off in different ways. But it was that kind of quintessential high concept, low budget movie. It was the perfect version of it. So I'd say Cube. There was a movie called Hoodwinked years ago that had really low production values. It was very cheaply made, but it was very smart. It was before Shrek, and it dealt with fairy tales in an adult way. And so that was just a really smart, low budget animated movie to make. I would say, look at Moonlight. I mean, Barry Jenkins now is, you know, he can do anything he wants now because he made a passionate movie that mattered, that was really inexpensive. Before Sunset, you know, a low budget romantic movie, one of the most romantic movies ever made, in my opinion. You can make that movie. Back when I was growing up, there was Sex, Lies, and Videotape was, again, another movie that was just really smart for the time, didn't cost anything, but it had an interesting point of view and an interesting approach to the making of it. So I think interesting approach to making movies. There's so many great influences today with all the different kinds of media. Don't stay in a particular lane if it doesn't feel right. If it does feel right, go for it. You know, Memento was another, you know, low budget movie. So that was Chris Nolan and his brother Jonathan Nolan who wrote it. Chris Nolan's making, you know, the biggest budget movies you can make right now. Tangerine, made just a few years ago on a cell phone. I would look at those kinds of movies. This is why I'm throwing out a bunch of titles, because it's whatever your interest is. Once was another, was a great musical movie that was really low budget, but it was, you know, told from the heart. It was very successful. And then the, you know, those filmmakers went on to make a movie with a bunch of movie stars in it after that. Same kind of movie. Science fiction movies, Primer. Primer is probably, you know, maybe the best example of all time of a science fiction movie that was made with no money and was super lo-fi, but really science fiction, really smart, creative science fiction ideas. So there you go. Anything that fits into that kind of category.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. Those are some really great recommendations. And thank you so much for coming on the show. And to those of you who ask questions, that is all for this episode of Film Kid Asks. Be sure to subscribe and feel free to follow us on Twitter and Instagram or join our Facebook group. New episodes come out every Saturday.